And the court will proceed to the third case, the United States versus Farr. Mr. Steinle?
May it please the court, my name is Michael Steinle and I represent Mr. Farr in this matter. And we have a single issue in this case, obviously, of whether or not a district court can order restitution as a condition of supervised release when it has failed to do under the Mandatory Victims Restitution Act. That is under 18 United States Code 3664A5. A district court must do it, and obviously it's a command. It must do it within the 90-day period. And in this case, it was not done under the 90-day period of time. The district court did not make any independent determination of the actual loss suffered by the banks in this case, only because the banks apparently had not gotten, their declaration of losses. There was no affidavits. There was no verified amounts at the time of restitution. But we did have a ballpark figure. And in that case, the government lawyer at the time indicated to the court that we would be getting a restitution amount later, and Judge Randa did not make any determination of restitution at that point. He basically put the matter off because pursuant to that statute, he has 90 days to do it. For whatever reason, the probation department and the government never got those to the district court, and I guess it fell through the cracks, and restitution was never ordered. Defendant does his time in prison, gets out of prison as part of a supervised release. A new probation officer comes along and then obviously looks in the file and says that this is a fraud case. Let's start getting your restitution. Defendant says, I've never been ordered to pay restitution. I've been asking for restitution figures since the day one of my pre-sentence report. I've demanded it, and now all of a sudden you're telling me I have to pay X, Y, and Z, and he doesn't want to pay the X, Y, and Z. And then the government, if you will, then tries to get him in and succeeds in getting him into court, and under the pretense that they can do this under supervised release as opposed to...
Yeah, I mean, that's where I wanted to kind of start, because it certainly is the case, if it were done at the right time, that a restitution order can be one of the conditions of supervised release. You would agree with that?
Absolutely.
Let me just take this one step further then. Suppose instead of putting amount to be determined, which is what the district court judge did, the district judge had put down a dollar as the amount of restitution. Terms of supervised release themselves can be revisited by courts before the term is over.
In that situation, they could have done it two ways. They could have done it pursuant to 3664A5. They could have done it because you have 60 days, if you can determine that now new losses are now known, we now have 60 days from the time the new losses are now known. So it opens, if you will, if you would have put a dollar down, it opens the window up. The government could have put down, judge, enter the 207 figure. I think that's not a right figure, but we'll amend it later. Then I think we wouldn't be here 3 years later, because I think the statute says we have 60 days from the time that we now discover that it wasn't right or that there's more actual losses. But in this case, they did not do that. They said they would do it within, or to be determined, and they said they would do it later on, and they never did it later on.
Well, the second question, which I'm sure you're prepared for, is whether this whole structure of 90 days or 60 days or any of the rest of it is for the benefit of people like Mr. Farr, or whether it's for the benefit of the victims. And even if it's late, if there's no victim out there saying, I wasn't part of the restitution order, get me in, why is Mr. Farr entitled to enforce this period of time?
Well, because time. I mean, we're entitled. Mr. Farr is entitled to a finality of a judgment, or an amended judgment in this case. He's entitled to that. He's entitled to know, and he was entitled under the statute to, if you will, argue, and he had his avenues to do that.
A form of statute of limitations, you would suggest.
Excuse me?
A form of statute of limitations.
Correct. Absolutely.
Once the time passes, the government has done nothing, the government's out of business.
Exactly. And it's not unlike anything else that this district has done or the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals has done. If I, as the defendant's lawyer, miss my 10-day statute, I mean my 10-day period for filing a notice of appeal, I know that there's no exceptions. And there's just news. I can't even get a district court to extend it to 11 days or 12 days. I'm just out of luck. And the government, in this case, honestly, is out of luck because they missed their time. And to go back to your question with regard to that hearing is if you do it as a condition of supervised release, there's no vehicle within the conditions of supervised release that lets Mr. Farr come in and say, hey, I don't agree with that figure. And he was always saying that because with regard to one of the properties, 3007, I think it's North 24th Street, that property had not even been sold at the time that he was sentenced, and they included a $27,000 figure in restitution toward the $200,000 to say that's part of restitution when the property wasn't even sold, and it is later sold. And then he also has, and he always wanted to argue, that in fact these properties were being sold for well below market value when in fact they could have been sold for something more. That is, as a $50,000 house is being sold for $12,000. Why is it? Why is the bank letting it go for $12,000, and who's purchasing that? So the condition of supervised release doesn't give the Mr. Farrs of the world at least the opportunity to do it. And if you're not going to give him the opportunity to contest the figure, in my opinion, you're not entitled to the figure. It's at least from what I know, there is no Seventh Circuit case that deals with this. Now, the government has cited several cases in their briefs with regard to the issuing of these orders, but all those orders are done, and it doesn't say these in the statement of facts. But you can, a good reading of the statute is what they're in those cases. I believe it's Cotman and Dodato. That has to do with specific things that the government is seeking as restitution that they're not entitled to under 3664, such as the drug buy money. And they're not entitled to drug buy money under 3664, so they're trying to get it under the conditions of supervised release, but they're all doing that within the 90-day period of time. So, again, all those cases that are cited by the government have to do with, if you will, all things that are they want to include that the Mandatory Victims Restitution Act doesn't apply to. Very, very quickly, I would like to also say that if you read 3563B2 says making restitution to the victims of the offense under 3556. If you go to 3556, the last sentence of 3556 says the procedures under 3564 shall apply. 3564 says you have to do it within 90 days.
Yeah, 3664, that's right. You take these two hops and it gets you back to the 90-day.
The condition of says go back to 3556, and 3556 says go back to 3664 per procedure, and that's 90 days. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Hoffman.
Yes. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Gail Hoffman. I represent the United States.
You don't have to do that. There's a little button down there if you push the thing.
I know, and with all due respect, I really don't want to bother with that. I've tried it once before in front of Judge Easterbrook, and it was a disaster, and I'm not even going.
All right,
what part of that was a disaster?
This is not a problem.
Let me be more specific. The button aspect of it was a disaster.
That's a different kind of
I was here several weeks ago, and it was suggested I do the same thing, and I'm just not going there today.
Okay.
Anyway.
Well, we can both see and hear you, Ms. Hoffman.
Great. Thank you. And I think in a nutshell, I'm not here to argue that what happened at the time of sentencing was the right way to do it, because it wasn't. I mean, the bottom line is restitution should have been imposed within the 90 days, and it wasn't. That said, so where are we today? And, you know, as it's often said, very often there's more than one way to accomplish a certain goal, and that's where we're at.
Different ways to skin a cat.
Right, exactly. That's exactly what it is. And, you know, we're here, and we looked at it and thought, okay, there's another way to skin this cat.
But the problem with your, I mean, that is true. And even putting to one side, though, the march through the statutes that Mr. Steinle was just reviewing, the disturbing thing to me of in general terms about the government's theory is that it reads the 90-day requirement absolutely out of the statute. Because if you can always say, oh, what the heck, there's no 90-day requirement if we just call it a condition of supervised release, then you have taken a general statute and you've allowed it to overrule a time period or erase, if you will, a time period in a more specific statute. And that's quite contrary to the way we normally try to make statutory schemes work together. When there's a more specific one, we require people to go through the procedures. And that's even, as I said, apart from going 3563 to 3556 over to 3664. And I, you know, it's too bad, but I see no sign here of this being Mr. Farr's fault. I mean, the government just dropped the ball. So maybe there won't be restitution this time.
Well, I don't know that the government totally dropped the ball, because all parties were aware at the time of sentencing. I mean, I wasn't at sentencing, but from reading the transcript and having been involved in the case, I did try the case with the attorney that was at sentencing. I did handle it. That attorney left the office. I've been handling it ever since. So I'm quite familiar with Mr. Farr. I handled the direct appeal. There was a direct appeal in this case. So, I mean, I do have some familiarity with these facts. And I don't know that dropping the ball is quite accurate.
Well,
yes, restitution was...
everybody knew about the 90-day rule, too, didn't they?
Absolutely. But
okay,
it was
just
clear,
like they knew the
right,
rule.
Well, I mean, I'm presuming everyone did. And I think it was...
And even if you didn't, you'd still be stuck with it.
There was some... I mean, I think there was some misinformation at the time. Restitution was clearly discussed at sentencing. I mean, it was part of the transcript. There was a discussion of loss. And when you look at the transcript from the sentencing, the defendant doesn't even submit any information contradicting the loss figure. And that loss figure is what is the initial figure that was used or bandied about to discuss restitution. The defendant came in and said, I'm innocent. I mean, it wasn't...
Well, he's not claiming surprise in the fact that he might get nailed with the restitution. As a matter of fact, he asked for it.
Right, and all through...
You didn't give it to him, Mr.
And
Payne.
All through these proceedings, I mean, he knew the general number that we were discussing.
But here he's saying the general number, and, you know, for most people anyway, maybe even Mr. Farr, you know, a couple $10,000 here or there makes a difference. And even in your brief, you have this mysterious footnote on page 13 that says, while the district court set restitution at $208,000 and some odd, the final calculation shows $199,176.21. You know, I don't know where that number came from. I'm sure Mr. Farr might want to have something to say about where
procedures
were just not followed in this
case. Actually, it's pretty clear where that figure came from.
Maybe to you, but sitting here reading these briefs, it is not clear.
If you look at the appendix, which is attached, the government filed a motion to supplement the record and included a letter that Sean Robinson, one of the United States probation officer who was handling Mr. Farr's supervision, submitted to ultimately to the defendant. And in that letter, it's I think appendix number 10 or 8 in my brief, 8, 9, 10, there's a it lays out how that number was calculated. So there's, and that $199,000 figure does not include interest. It does not include attorney fees. So I think
my only point is, though, it's a one-sided figure where the officer said it appears Mr. Farr owes restitution at this $199 and something number. There is a procedure. We get appeals from time to time. You've probably defended some of them where people complain about amounts of restitution. It's not one of those facts like, you know, did the sun rise at 6:18 this morning or whenever it rose? It's a disputable fact.
And absolutely. And if he wants to submit some information, and there is a long period of time where Mr. Farr had these discussions with his probation officer, and it was set out, this is how this number was calculated, but at no time during his sentencing or thereafter did he ever say,
Why was it in his interest to initiate this? When the judge has put to be determined, is he supposed to come back and say, please sentence me some more?
No, but it's on the government. But after
this.
It came to light, I mean, after Mr. Robinson did initiate these conversations with him, he said, listen, this is the amount that we've calculated. I understand you don't agree. This is our figure. But at no point did he suggest that, all right, it shouldn't, you know, the house was undersold. You know, I'm familiar with this area, and I think $18,000 was too low, even though, because the principal amount in the loan was $50,000, and that's what I bought it for. Putting that aside, and I see there are, I'm sorry.
All I'm saying is, how, if all of that's right, how do you get around 3664? Because if you're saying this is a 3563B2 condition of supervised release, it seems to me you are led inevitably to 3664 in the same 90-day time limit that you don't want.
Except it says under 3563 sub B2, it says, but not subject to the limitation of section 3663A.
I know it, but that's fine. You go under 3563B2, though, over to the general statute, 3556, which applies to anything. That's actually conditions order of restitution, not only 3663A, also 3663, and also then it says, having mentioned those two statutes, the procedures under section 3664 shall apply to all orders of restitution under this section. And the reason that 3563 ends up being under this section is because it tells you to go to 3556. It's a cross-reference. You know, make restitution to a victim of the offense under section 3556. And the 90 days isn't in 3663A or 3663AC2. It's in 3664.
And with all due respect, I think that but not subject to the limitation of section 3663 takes it out of that, because if you look at the cases that where restitution has been applied as a condition of supervised release, the cases out of this district which relate to buy money, as Mr. Steinle indicated, I mean, in those cases restitution, the restitution of the buy money was set outside the 90-day time period.
Well, first of all, those are not from this court. Whatever the Northern District of Illinois is doing is its problem. But I don't think this court has ever said that 3664 has nothing to say about this. 3663A sets forth certain kinds of offenses that are subject to mandatory as opposed to discretionary restitution. Nobody disagrees. Those limitations don't apply to a condition of supervised release. And there are other limitations in 3663, but I really am not sure how you get away from 3664.
I'm sorry, when I didn't mean to say district, I meant circuit, because there are two cases cited that relate to buy money were cases where I believe one was Datto and the other, I forget the name of it right now, but I believe Judge Evans wrote those opinions, and in those cases, buy money was imposed as restitution as a condition of supervised release.
But that's not, everyone agrees with you that it can be a condition of supervised release. There's no question about that. The question is, what do you infer about the relevant time periods? Of course it can be a condition of supervised release, but can you do it in this time frame?
And I think we may disagree here, but I mean, I think we do from our questions, but I really do believe that under 3583 sub D, because that it regulates the conditions of supervised release, and it refers you on to, you know, permissible conditions, 3563, and one of them, B2, is restitution to a victim. And I think if you look at the cases, there have been in this circuit and other circuits, there have been restitution amounts that have been set beyond the 90 days. I mean, I know no one's addressed this particular statute that you're citing to, but there are instances and opinions where...
Isn't there, Ms. Hoffman, an equitable focus you applied to those cases? In other words, what are the equities here, other than the policy of restitution, to make victims as whole as they can be? Where are the government equities here? I mean, isn't that where you stand somewhat empty-handed?
Well, I think in, I mean, obviously it's, we wouldn't be here if it was opposed under the MVRA. However, if it were imposed under the MVRA, for instance, once he discharges from supervision, that restitution figure would follow him. He couldn't discharge it in bankruptcy. It would, the government would have a lien. It would be there. Now, if the court allowed Judge Randa's order to stand, once his supervised release expires, this order of restitution expires also. And, you know, he did commit these offenses. I mean, granted, we didn't do it within the 90-day period. He did commit these offenses. He did obtain these sums of money through deceit. The
I think you're obviously right in the recitation of those facts. I guess my inquiry is, if we can even get around the statutory problems that Judge Wood has so clearly laid out, what would be the principle that we would seem to be following in sort of cutting the government slack on its procedure?
But it's not necessarily cutting the government slack, because the victims were out these money.
Well, there's no question
right.
about
and
the
so
equities. Of
course, if he had blown the statute of limitations and hadn't indicted him in time, they'd still be out and he'd still be free. And he wouldn't have anything, because you blew the statute of limitations for whatever reason you did, right?
Right. I mean, that
there would be no reason to pop in, because these poor victims were stuck with your problem. We couldn't do anything about it.
Right, but in this particular case, there appears to be an avenue where we can do something about it.
Well, that's,
and
he said, "Why? Why should we?" That's what the question is.
First of all, it's the fair and just. It's the right thing to do. It's not. You're not taking anything. I think it is. You're not taking anything away from the defendant.
Well, I didn't say you didn't take it away. No, hold on a minute.
Sorry.
I didn't suggest that there was anything laughable at your being saying you're right. You may be right as a matter of moral issue. We're not talking that. We're talking law. And I want a legal reason for us to do what you ask us to do. Have you got one you can give us? Any legal reason?
Yes, 3580.
Other than the one you've discussed with Judge Wood. If the answer to that is no, I have no further questions.
No, the answer, I mean, it's a weighing. You also have to balance the purpose of supervised.
Equitably, we have to weigh the balance.
You have to weigh the balance of supervised release. This is a defendant. This is a defendant who has shown no remorse for his crime. This is a defendant who's shown no accountability for it. This is a defendant who, to this very day, continues to deny his guilt. And, you know, I won't belabor the whole, you know, condition of supervised release, but I do believe that's a legal and equitable way to impose supervised release in this case and under the law of the circuit and looking at other cases that address this issue.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Hoffman.
Thank you.
Mr. Steinle?
Very briefly, Your Honors. Two things. It's fair to assume that Mr. Farr in this case contested every single thing that the government did. He put the government to its proof. In the transcript, he said, I want to challenge, and I think his words were, the verified amounts. And the verified amounts were not available at sentencing, and they were not filed. To this day, he's never been shown verified amounts. He's been shown a letter is all he's been doing from Sean Robinson to another lawyer that was representing him at the time. That's all. He still has not been shown what is supposed to be declaration of losses, but what he said in the transcripts, I want and I'm entitled to the verified amounts. And they still haven't done that. They've given him a summary letter of what their
position is. Okay,
you
made that point.
Excuse me?
I see you made that point.
Okay.
Go ahead.
But the second point on that is in my opinion, what the district court did in this order is all they did was is delegate his discretion, which in my opinion is abuse of discretion, which is the standard here. He delegated his discretion to the probation department to determine, because I argued in front of Judge Randa, fine, if you say that they can do this as a
period. But your big point is the 90 days, not the amount.
Correct. And just lastly, with regard to the victims of this case, the banks in this case, the banks have legal departments on top of legal departments that they've spent hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. Those are lawyers that didn't get the verified claims. In all seriousness, it's not just some poor old lady that is out the money. These are institutions that have people responsible for recovering their losses, and they didn't do it. Thank you.
All right. Our thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement. The court